Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host Niklas Sävås, and with me in the studio today is my friend Henrik Andersson. Today we're excited to speak to Torbjörn Arenbo, Chief Analyst and Head of Corporate Advisory Sweden at Danske Bank. Arenbo has 25 years experience working as a corporate finance advisor, portfolio manager and risk manager. So Henrik, which book will we speak about today?
We will talk about his book, Capital Allocation and Value Creation, a market-based framework for executives. It was published actually late last year, but a new edition early this year. So it's a very recent hot off the press title. So even though this is a podcast with a very global outlook, the investment book world has no boundaries, as we like to say. It's with an extra little bit of pride. We have the opportunity to speak with a fellow Swedish author. They are perhaps few in numbers, but they do produce great content.
And what do you think about the book?
I really do think it's a brilliant book with a direct and a very clear message. Unfortunately, capital allocation is not taught at universities per se as a coherent topic. You have to put the pieces of the puzzle together yourselves, so to speak. And even worse, it doesn't get the attention it deserves in the executive suite or in the boardrooms. So a simple call out to board members and executives would be buy this book, have a mini seminar about it, and really embrace the concepts. I also like the fact that it's written for corporate leaders, not investors. It adds a different language, and it the structure of the book is somewhat new as an investor.
Capital Allocation and Value Creation was published in December 2023, and we are delighted to discuss it with the author today. Here comes our conversation with Torbjörn Arenbo. Hi, Torbjörn, and welcome to the Investing by the Books podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Delightful to be here.
We're delighted to have you on, and thanks for taking the time. Where are you today?
Well, today I'm in my hometown, which is Malmö in the southern part of Sweden, close to Copenhagen, where I've been working for quite a few years now.
And a common question for us is we're of course curious to hear more about your background and where your passion for investing started.
Yeah, it's a good question. Where did it start? I guess I made my first transaction in high school, and was a bit lucky. So it actually paid for my first trip to the Alps skiing. So on that road it is, I guess. When I went to high school, I had a math teacher that kind of proposed that, have you thought about studying economics? Well, I didn't really know what economics was, but in terms of national economics, not business administration. So I went down that route. I guess I had a math head, and at Lund University, I met this fabulous guy, Per Fremberg, who was my tutor, and he left for Alecta Investment Management when he's finished his PhD, and I kind of followed his footsteps. So it's a lot of coincidence and chance.
So, Torbjörn, today we will speak about your book, Capital Allocation and Value Creation. Tell us, how did this book come about?
Well, the last two decades I've been working in this financial intermediary investment bank in Copenhagen, and met a lot of clients talking about funding, you know, from a bank's perspective, but coming from the asset management side, I kind of thought of myself as an investor more than a deal maker. And I also saw some differences in the approach to value creation in the two different worlds. And my aim and struggle have been to try to link those two sides. So link value creation to issues like capital structure and funding. But I guess that is the origin of my interests and eventually the writings of the book. But it's a long story. It's been together with my two great colleagues, Peter Tregarski and Oskar Haglund. We've been working on this setup, which is described in the book, for roughly 10 years. And they were invited, both of them, to participate in the writing of the book. But due to personal reasons, having small kids, they turned my offer down, unfortunately. But still, they are extremely important in the creation of this framework that we present in the book.
I mean, you mentioned those two colleagues and friends, and we're all products of different inspirations and people you meet in the industry, having worked for so long. Have you had any other inspirations or sources of references when writing this book?
Yeah, I think when you try to link the corporate executives' ways of cash flow deployment and capital allocation to the asset management side of things, investor side of things, I think there are some outstanding people. I mean, Warren Buffett, of course, goes without saying, and took quite a few readings of this book I mentioned in the book, Cunningham's, and to understand what he really meant by capital allocation. So, but aside from him, I think you can mention guys like you have actually interviewed on the podcast. So it's extremely, I'm honestly honored to be in the same podcast as those guys that you have interviewed with, like Mabusan. He's a great writer, and he written some books, and he also written a lot of papers that are accessible on his homepage. So he's a really great inspirational source. And Thorndike, of course, who you also interviewed. And I also read this book about Edward Chancellor some years back, which I liked as well. All guys you have had interviews with.
Yeah, we're often awestruck ourselves when speaking to these people, of course.
Yeah.
But I guess that Mr. Cunningham and Will Thorndike and so forth are not the people you've had in front of you, you know, imagining when you wrote this book. I guess your primary audience is someone else. Who did you have in mind, or who did you see in front of yourself when you structured the book?
Yeah, absolutely true, Henrik. Yeah. Well, since I've been working at an investment bank for so long, I get to meet the corporate clients primarily. So corporate executives of various degrees, you know, group treasurers, CFOs, CEOs, board members. Throughout the years, I guess I've gotten to know what, you know, on average, they're like from a mind, where they come from a knowledge base, but also where they have their focus and stuff like that. So what I've been trying to build up is this link between the investors' way of thinking and convey that message to corporate executives in an easy and digestible way. And that the framework is well described by the words capital allocation, I guess. So that's where we come from, so to say. So we have a little bit of a different angle compared to many other books in the, or at least we hope so, compared to many other books out there, because a lot of books about value creation for investors, maybe not so much directed towards corporate executives, and maybe not so much as a practical handbook or framework, which we have tried to make the book as.
So having read lots of books in between ourselves in this podcast, I mean, we think that a very underappreciated part of a book is how you structure it, how you build up the chapters, how you come to conclusions, and how you sort of keep readers on their toes, and we very much like the structure in this book. Can you tell us a bit more of your thoughts here?
Oh, thanks. On your toes for a theoretical book like mine. That's the best. That's the best feedback I've ever gotten, I think. No, but joke aside, I think you need to, when you meet corporate executives, you have to be aware that they have an extremely busy everyday life, right? So work life days, and so you need to be quite, I guess, firm in your way of the pedagogical approach. So that's what we've been trying to enhance, and we've been practicing that throughout hundreds of client meetings during the past 10 years. So I just try to, you know, convert the meetings we have into something that is written and do it in a way that would suit, at least I would hope would suit our client base or the target group for the book, which you already mentioned, it's on more on the corporate side than on the investor side. However, it's two sides of the same coin, right? So it's more of a structural issue. So it's not that, I think, new in the book as such. It's more the way it's presented and structured.
You also write that you hope the book will inspire to help answer the very important but often overlooked question of what good capital allocation really means. So without revealing too much of the contents of the book, obviously, can you just whet our listeners' appetite a little bit here and mention a few of the nuggets?
Well, yeah, but I've been struggling with, you know, finding out what is really good capital allocation. I mean, this is a huge issue, right? So that's what's been intriguing me for these very many years. And I think when you hear the term capital allocation in connection with Warren Buffett, it almost takes on a mythical aura, right? It's like this holy grail. And once you solve it, you're in happiness and rich for the rest of your life. But it's about making decisions around resource allocation. And what I've come across meeting all these corporate clients, I think you have to know that it extends beyond just growth or increased margins. One important ingredient is to think like an investor. And risk return is one of those basic foundations of thinking like an investor. But I also think thinking like an investor includes reading the market and understanding the markets in a good way. And those are good things for any capital allocators, no matter if he or she is on the asset side or the corporate side. And once you know how to read and understand the market, you can decide or you can decode the three value drivers, and profitability, growth, and cost of capital, much easier. So it's a very good starting point for decisions further down the road. So I guess that's a little bit of a starting step for a good understanding of what capital allocation really means.
We will go in a bit more into those. And I mean, you mentioned that we have had Will Thorndike on the show, and we had him on the show on episode 30. And I mean, in his book, The Outsiders, he, of course, talked about the different ways for how a company can allocate capital. And I think you take this one step further in terms of how you rank the different alternatives in terms of the base rate for success. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, no, you put it at base rate of success. I think it's a good way of putting it. I'm a bit more simplistic, I guess, but it ties back to the risk reward thinking, where you have different options to allocate your capital, of course, but they're not just they shouldn't just be measured by success or profitability. They should also be measured by a risk yardstick, right? So you put it in an investor's way of thinking, and investors are extremely good at thinking in those terms. they're trained throughout their entire work life, I guess. But that's not really the case when you move over to the other side. Actual capital allocation caters to a pretty large extent, based on my experience, are less prone to incorporate risk in their allocation decisions. So I think that's an important part of the book to convey the quite difficult message of thinking in terms of risk, especially for people that are entrepreneurs. They don't think in terms of risk like that, but investors do. So how do they meet each other in a good way?
I think an overall message that you gave in the book with all the company examples is that it's very individual in terms of, I mean, how a company should structure its capital allocation strategy, depending on, of course, the circumstances. But I mean, one example that's quite intriguing for me, who works with a lot of serial acquirers, is that the most successful serial acquirers are often making small and many acquisitions, and not like seldom large ones. And especially they buy private companies and not public companies as well, which you also bring up in the book as bolt-on acquisitions having a higher return than large acquisitions. I think serial acquirers is something you bring up with a lot of the examples in the book, having compounded at great returns for a long time. And I often come back to the Bergman and Beving companies. They actually started in the 80s to focus all their private companies. They focused on the companies that had low returns on capital should come up before they are able to do any terms of growth initiatives. And that's been sort of a model for success for Bergman and Beving, but also the spun-off entities such as Lagercrantz and AdTech. I just want to go back. I mentioned a bit on this that large acquisitions that are done seldom don't have a great base rate for success. And part of it, in my view, could be that the company itself isn't really structured to make acquisitions. They are not pros in making acquisitions. They are pros on actually improving operations and allocate capital to organic initiatives and so on. So I'm just curious to know more about your view on what's the most common failures with acquisitions.
Yeah, I think on the base rate, I think acquisitions differ the most between what kind of acquisitions you make. And I guess it takes a lot of practice to become skilled at making acquisitions, which the serial acquirers actually are a good example of. I also think one of the most common mistakes are overstating synergies. That's not from my experience, but from academic studies. And then more based on my gut feeling is that, you know, the biggest mistakes in the Nordics have been made by companies in mature markets, which try to find growth outside their core markets, whether that could be in new products like Ericsson or in new markets, geographical markets like Telia. It's a very, very, very extremely low base rate of success for those kind of acquisitions, and partly I think that is due not only to stuff like buying big companies, includes buying, you know, listed companies, which are always bought at a premium. So the price, of course, is a big hurdle. But it also entails stuff like culture. If you, for example, work, you know, banks are a good example of that. They are it's a shrinking business. Eventually, it will shrink over time, and then they try to buy something that is enhancing growth, like Ericsson and Telia. But you know, it's very hard to combine a cost conscious culture with an entrepreneurial culture, and I think a lot of corporate executives have underestimated the difficulties handling different cultures within the same organization.
I mean, this obsession of growth that seems to be the case both for investors but also operators sometimes. I mean, why is that so strong, you think?
That's a really good question. When I speak with CEOs and boards, I think they all, and this is quite understandable, and I have no good answer to the question, but they of course want to energize their organization, right? And how do you do that? You typically energize an organization with growth, you know, the way forward, we're moving ahead, we're doing that. But for a lot of companies, that's not what the capital allocation value creation priority looks like. It might be profitability, it might be earnings quality or some other driver, right? But it's so much more difficult to energize an organization with, you know, cost savings or higher quality. So I think for a lot of executives, they go for growth. You know, we're on our way to a better future. We are growing. It's much more fun. I think that is part of the story for so many companies doing poor capital allocation decisions. And the next step in this journey is, of course, that they put targets and KPIs and incentive structures that are aligned with energizing the company. So I think you have to start from the beginning in those instances and really ask what kind of driver is the one that we should prioritize and try to find a story that is aligned with that value driver. But it's difficult. So it's quite understandable that a lot of companies have difficulties in finding the internal story for their employees.
And a company that has been a really successful growth story is, of course, Nibe, with Gert-Erik Lindqvist at the helm for, I think, around 30 years now. And Nibe has been one of the great success stories on the Swedish stock market for the last 30 years. And you have a section in the book where you have actually interviewed Gert-Erik. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've had been extremely fortunate to follow and work with Gert-Erik and Hans Backman, the CFO of Nibe, for many years. And much of what Gert-Erik says actually echoes what Warren Buffett has said about acquisitions and about being the preferred buyer of a company. And I think at least Gert-Erik is a man of believing in having a culture, a very strong culture, and building trust around that culture. And he stands for what he says, right? So he's really trustworthy in his message. So when, and I think this probably goes for a lot of your serial acquirers targets as well, but if you're an entrepreneur and you want to sell your company, it might be the case that money isn't the highest top priority. It might be the legacy of the firm. You want to put it in some good hands. And if that's the case, the trustworthiness of the buyer is extremely important. And that's, I guess, where Nibe has been successful. They have a decentralized organization. They have a very strong entrepreneurial local management handling the business. A strong culture, as I mentioned, extremely customer-centric and commitment to innovation. And I think that culture fits is extremely important for Gert-Erik, and when he meet entrepreneurs, he's become very skilled at telling if he's got a good feel for the soul of the company out there.
Well, that's definitely something I want to echo with. I mean, you mentioned the similarities with serial acquirers, and it's a bit different in terms of sometimes these company structure. The former CEO and owner as being part of the new company for a few years, and they structure it with an earnout or some minority shareholding and so on. And sometimes the former CEO is let go immediately, so it's a bit different there, and depending of course on the situation. But is that something that you think is a big driver for the success, that that actually management are kept in place, or is it more the actually, I mean, the structure and framework that the new company incorporates into the acquired company?
I think local management is extremely important for acquirers far away from your home market, because you don't have the ability and access to good CEOs. You can't put them in place, and that's what Warren Buffett says as well. They're extremely important ingredients in the evaluation of an acquisition. Is management good? Can you trust them? Because you can't find them yourself, basically.
And it's also something to keep in mind, I think, in the life cycle of an acquisitive company. I mean, Nibe is big, and if they acquire a company that they have some problems with the former management, they probably have a list of people that they could set into that company, as they have quite a few CEOs of the different business units.
Yeah, I don't know about Nibe. It's a good question, but I think for Atlas Copco, that would be true. But for a lot of other companies, I think, they are geographically dispersed, they're extremely decentralized, head office extremely small, they don't have that kind of resources. I think they operate maybe in a little bit different way, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so from actual practices on the factory floor, back to a little bit of theory from the book. You have something you call the three value drivers: growth, profitability, and the required rate of return. And growth needs no introduction, as we've spoken about. But profitability, how do you define that in the capital allocation sense of the word?
It's return on invested capital, if you want to be theoretically correct, but it doesn't matter really, I think, if it's a return on capital employed or some other asset-based measure. However, it's not margin. That's a big mistake people do out there, I think. You have to account for the capital needed to create that margin. But taking a step back, the three value drivers is something McKinsey came up with, right? The valuation book. So I use the McKinsey, or we use the McKinsey setup. So they are the one that should be honored. And I think it's so good in so many ways, because it's tied to the discounted cash flow model, right? In a steady state, you can derive it from the cash flow model. But it lacks some of the, bad reputation the DCF model has. It has a really poor reputation in many, many places. But the three value drivers also ties into multiples, right? And multiples are used frequently on both sides, in the financial markets, corporate side, and investment management side. But to my experience, I think a lot of people don't really know what's baked into the multiple. And the multiple could quite easily derive into those three value drivers, the third one being cost of capital. So you have growth, profitability, as in return on invested capital, and cost of capital. So for pedagogical reasons, I think it's really great. And once you have come that far, you can start to think about the trade-off between the three value drivers. So that's a bit tricky as well. It's not tricky as such mathematically, but you have to decipher the formula, and you have to realize that the relationship between these three drivers, it's not linear. It's non-linear, which makes it quite hard to grasp intuitively. So that's why I like McKinsey's setup so much.
Right. The cost of capital or return requirement has been, in a CAPM sense of the word, a little bit perhaps misused in a low interest rate environment. How would you advise a corporate executive or an investor to use the K part of the equation, or the cost of capital?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one, this one. Because when it comes to cost of capital, I think it's much better if you get it roughly right than precisely wrong, right? And I think the CAPM is a great model, but I also think it's been overused. If you ask Modigliani Miller, I don't think they intended it to be used like it's been. So it comes with some flaws, of course. And I think you can use it, and you can try to elaborate on your cost of capital through beta and stuff like that. But it's historical numbers and all those kind of things that are difficult to handle. But you can also view it. You can ask investors about their return requirements, which are frequently done. But you can, like we prefer to do it, you can backtrack it from from a discounted cash flow model and solve the market value by the cost of capital. And it's, of course, it's quite tricky, and you should be careful, but we've done it for a lot of companies, and we like calibrate it with all these other ways of finding out what cost of capital you have. So I think we could get it roughly right. We hope at least to avoid getting it precisely wrong. So that's our stance of looking at it.
And is that quite similar to, I mean, we've talked about Michael Mauboussin before, and he has this great book, Expectations Investing, where he actually backtracks, I mean, the DCF model. Is it similar method that you use, or?
Yeah, I've been reading his book. I really liked it, and this is exactly the same line of reasoning as he laid out in his book. But
So,
it's more an art than a science. That's for sure.
we talked a bit. I mean, you mentioned your interest in the capital structure, and I mean, one way for companies to return money to shareholders is, of course, through buybacks or dividends. And as you state, I mean, managers and the board needs to understand if their stock is undervalued when embarking on a buyback scheme. I'm curious to know, I mean, with all your experience talking to executives and boards, how often do you think they actually, I mean, have that understanding that they need? And in terms of what you have seen in terms of buyback schemes, how often are they value creating?
I think in the Nordic space, you have to look at buybacks from a different perspective. It's a way of returning cash to investors, not a way to create value. And that might be a good thing, but I think it revolves around flexibility of your liquidity position more than actually doing a profit buying undervalued shares, like the Warren Buffett approach leans more towards. So I think very few companies have the desirability to actually go and say that, oh, our intrinsic value is way above the market value, so we buy back shares. I think it works a bit differently for several good reasons, to be honest. But of course, tying back to Thorndike's book, the US story is quite differently. And a lot of CEOs in his book were aggressive buyers of their own share, and that was a big part of the total shareholder return story. But I don't know if I would recommend it. In some instances, yes, but you have to be careful there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in one way, I mean, looking at, for example, serial acquirers that often trades, I mean, at quite high multiples, and they are able to reallocate capital at, I mean, through buying companies at maybe, I mean, a PE multiple of 9, 10 or something like that. They get quite a good return through that if they also are able to improve the operations of that business. And to compare that with buying your own shares at a PE of 40, maybe, of course, is you don't need to do so much math in order to understand what's the better option. And that's maybe often the case that it is quite a big difference in terms of those alternatives that the companies have. A thing I've been thinking quite a lot about is that you don't see buybacks as prevalent in Europe as in US. Do you have a reason for that for us?
Yeah, I don't have a strong view on that one, but I think it's partly due to historical reasons, regulatory change differences historically, and also tax, of course, differences historically, and also coming back to Thorndike's book, tax issues was actually a big part of the stories over there, but it's been aligned to a much larger extent today. So, but it could also be due to differences in the investor preferences and sector differences. If you have a mature sector, stable cash flows, it's preferable, I guess, to have dividends. You know, if you want have investors that are more yield oriented, also makes sense to have a stable dividend. So I guess it's a lot of differences or different explanations for why the US and Europe have embarked on different tracks. Maybe incentive programs have something to do with it as well. US being more EPS driven, I guess. Yeah, I can think of some different explanations to your question there.
Too few Henry Singletons and Warren Buffetts in Europe, inspiring corporates and investors, perhaps. But it might come. So the term earnings quality is mentioned quite a bit throughout the book. Can you elaborate a bit about what you mean by this?
Yeah, earnings quality in our understanding is tied to the cost of capital. So it's a value driver in itself, right? So we wanted to make it a little bit easier. So everyone talks about growth and margins, right? But let's talk about the cost of capital, and it ties into the earnings quality. And from an academic point of view, I think earnings quality often means reporting quality, not so much predictability and persistence of cash flow and earnings, which tend to be the main investor focus. So we try to come up with a way of measuring this, since we really believe that investors like earnings quality, not least since the pandemic and the increase in inflation and volatility of cash flows. But you know, we haven't found anything really good to copy. So we basically took the EBIT margin volatility and normalized it with the EBIT margin level, a bit technical, but basically the EBIT margin. I think it correlates quite okay with the cost of capital from the other perspectives we just talked about. So there's quite strong correlation, I think, between earnings quality and long-term returns. That's a higher than growth, actually, in the numbers we calculated.
I think this was a really interesting perspective. I haven't really thought about it this way, that, I mean, having a low margin volatility is so important for the valuation of the company through the lower cost of capital. I mean, how many companies do you think understands this? We talked about the obsession of growth, but I think I often hear managers speak about, I mean, they should increase margins. And especially, I mean, I go back to the serial acquirers, and some of them have had this great margin journeys through acquiring companies with slightly higher margins over time. And we hear that on conference calls sometimes, that the manager speaks about they want to buy higher margin companies, and now the pool of companies that they can buy is smaller due to that there are fewer companies with high margins. Why do you think, I mean, tying that back to everything we have talked about, I mean, why do you think this obsession of margin is there as well?
Well, margin is a very important value driver. I mean, growth is a very important value driver, but it's viewed in isolation. It's not always the case, because sometimes growth and margin expansion comes at the cost of earnings quality. I mean, look at the companies we mentioned earlier. I mean, Ericsson and Telia being two good example of that. But there's a lot of other examples as well. If you know the medtech company Getinge, they've been it's a very good company, but they've been aiming for growth for a long time, and you know, they have difficulties with FDA in their acquired units. That's an example of how growth and earnings quality can be on opposite sides. And then, of course, there are a lot of other companies where they are aligned. I mean, this is actually, I think, in a sense, earnings quality is linked to competitive advantages and durable business model. And that's what Buffett calls economic moats. So Buffett is, as I read him, understand him, he advocates earnings quality in the terms of economic moats.
Going back to my question a bit, I mean, it seems like companies are more obsessed about increasing margin than increasing the return on capital, is something that I thought about quite a lot when I read the book as well. Is that something you agree on, and is this due to that the managers don't really understand all the concepts that you bring up in the book, or?
Yeah, Niklas, I think you're right, hitting the spot. I think just look at the targets out there for big companies. It's growth and margin, right? And it's nothing wrong with having a margin target, but you need to understand that it takes capital to achieve. So I think linking margin to a target or a success, value creation success, I think you need to know how much capital that is required to achieve that. Some companies have perfectly good understanding of this, Atlas Copco being one, for example. But I've also met numerous companies that have poor understanding of how value actually is created. So, and that is why one of the reasons why I put this together, the book together in the first place. So I think if you're an investor, I don't know if your listeners are more on the investor side. If you want to find out whether you want to buy shares in a company, and you get to speak to the CEO, you could ask some questions around capital allocation just in order to see if he or she understands the way, the theoretical way at least, value is created. And I also think that for some bigger companies, the market is really good at telling whether they have confidence in management or not by giving the company a conglomerate discount. So that's why I know. And this is something we work with quite a lot, you know, to explain to companies with different divisions how they could try to eliminate the conglomerate discount.
The question to Henrik, I mean, you have been a fund manager for a long time and met a lot of executives, of course. Do you think they grasp the concepts Torbjörn is teaching?
Generally, no. There has actually been a part of the fund I used to manage that we devoted so little to capital allocators as a competitive edge, like being a low-cost producer or the blue ocean, creating a new market, competitive advantages and so forth. So when we met companies who really understand capital allocation, we think they have a competitive advantage in how they run the company per se, which has been actually a source of some of our best investments over time. And I think there are two reasons mainly for companies not perhaps grasping this very well. And the first one is obviously that most corporate executives or leading people are too short term. Capital allocation works over long periods of time, and their main attitude, I think, is I'm not going to be there over the long term. So it, more often than not, you see good capital allocation and good thinking in family-oriented companies or people like who have the Warren Buffett setup, you know, I think 50 years ahead or 100 years ahead. The second reason is that return on invested capital or return on capital employed is too complex, they say, CEOs. I mean, my people on the factory floor don't understand that. But I think that it mainly relates to the fact that they don't really want to understand it. Margin is easier. It's something that could be more easily manipulated and so forth. So and it's funny when I listened to Torbjörn just a few minutes ago, one of our favorite questions has been around this when we meet companies. So the number one question I always asked was, what other companies do you admire in your industry or other companies? I often got great answers. And the second question was, can you explain to me how you think about capital allocation? And that could set a meeting on fire, or it could actually, the exact opposite could happen. But it was often revealing. So I think it's very few companies that grasp it, and it's a competitive edge as an investor to find them.
And going back a bit to the book, I mean, you mentioned short-sightedness as one of the issues, and that's something we see maybe in the political system as well. And I mean, speaking about macroeconomics, I mean, you have a chapter of that in the book, and it's been a bit difficult times the last years and decades with a lot of crisis. And what's your recommendation, Torbjörn, in terms of companies preparing and handling challenging market situations?
Yeah, so I mean, being a micro economic analyst is hard enough. Being a macroeconomic analyst is probably the most difficult thing you can take on our workspace. But it ties into the discussion about cash flow volatility, right? And financial tail risk. I think that's an applicable way of thinking about it if you're a corporate executive. And in turn, you could think about the capital structure and financial insurance, as we like to mention it. And then it becomes a little bit more tangible. You can think of yourself. Basically, when it comes to at least capital structure, what kind of capital structure is suitable for my business? Well, basically, I think there are all three kind of buckets. You have a good value creation potential, then you should probably prioritize financial flexibility because you don't add that much value by leveraging up your balance sheets. If you have a volatile cash flow, cyclical, have low return invested capital, again, you should insure against financial distress. Same outcome, a low capital, a low leverage and a good capital financial insurance. However, for low growth and high return invested capital companies, leverage could make a lot of sense for various reasons. You lower the cost of capital probably, but you also you also eliminate some of the risks connected to poor capital allocation decisions, like growing a slow business and stuff like that. So put a liquidity overlay to this insurance concept. I guess that's how we, in a more tangible way, try to link it to the macroeconomics.
And a more detailed question is, I mean, after the pandemic, we all know about, I mean, the component shortages and, I mean, the problems with supply chain. And what we have seen maybe in 2023 is that companies brought back inventories, I mean, down from having elevated levels in 2022. Do you think there is a lesson here for companies? And, I mean, should inventories maybe be a bit higher due to potential problems with the supply chain in the long term? I mean, is there a lesson there that companies should learn and haven't, or how do you think about that?
Well, I don't know specifically when it comes to working capital, but I do know that it's really good if you have a balance sheet and funding setup that can handle a much higher working capital, because we, on a bigger scale, we could see that 2022, I guess it was, and three maybe as well, one of the biggest capital outlays were actually a working capital increases. So, and that's a fundamental part of running a business, right? So, and I mean, over time, it's nice if you can reduce your cost of capital or your tied up capital by decreasing the working capital, but you have to find a balance there.
And if we pivot a bit to your current role at Danske Bank, can you please tell us about your role there?
Yeah, it's been heading up the corporate finance advisory department for quite a few years, and that's been my platform for meeting all these fantastic clients and entrepreneurs during the past years. It's been very good entry points to a lot of interesting discussions, both public and non-public. And I think it's been a fantastic learning experience meeting all these great people out there.
And how many interactions has it been, like yearly? How many executives have you met?
Oh, I don't know. But it's been a few, and I think that's a great part about my job, meeting all these great people, to be honest.
And
so
do you
it's
have
extremely rewarding.
Do you have a top three in terms of executives that you could name?
Well, if I had, I wouldn't reveal it, I guess.
I had to try.
But I guess Jart-Erik, he took the time to write in my book, so I guess he's high up on that list.
He would expect a medal position on the podium.
Definitely a medal, and probably a very valuable medal as well.
You've been a portfolio manager, though, before. How was that experience, and why on earth did you quit?
I guess I would get that question from you, Henrik. And to be honest, it was in my youth, and I didn't know really what I was doing. But we got our first child, and I got an offer from Danske Bank, relocating to Copenhagen, where we were originally from that area. So if I knew what I did, I probably maybe not would have done what I actually did. But I can't complain. I got that portfolio manager role a bit early on in my career. It would have been much better to switch these two experiences.
But now you have conveyed a lot of lessons for new allocators as well. I mean, I think it was a really great learning experience to read your book. And I mean, having that perspective, actually for operators is, of course, great. And I know that we have quite a few listeners, actually, that are operators themselves. So hopefully they take this discussions that we have had to buy the book and read it thoroughly and incorporate the lessons into their daily work. I think that's the most important thing here, and also for investors such as myself, I think it was a great perspective. And even though you wrote the book for operators, I think it was really valuable also for me as an investor. And I mean, as we all know, I mean, this is a book podcast, and we also always want to wrap up with questions about reading and writing. And I'm curious to know, Torbjörn, what book shaped you in the early innings of your investing career?
Yeah. Well, I guess it's the books mentioned in my book, and the guys we talked about in the beginning, visiting your podcast. So I mean, Edward Chancellor, Capital Returns, I found really interesting from the investor perspective. But then, of course, Buffett, with his way of conveying capital allocation skills, he got his own very entertaining ways of teaching us. But there are a lot of I'm really grateful for a lot of writers that have been generous enough to share so much of their informational knowledge. Amar Bosan is really, really great. I like his two books as well. I can recommend Expectations Investing, we talked about already, Think Twice, another great book of his, and all the papers he and Dan Callahan has been writing throughout the years. They're a bit more technical, some of them, but extremely generous to make that public and for us to read, to be honest. And then being coming from the more economic side of things and not so much business administration, I think Magretta's book about understanding Michael Porter was really good for me. So that's something I can recommend as an entry book on the subject competitive advantage. Yeah, and right now I'm reading a book, a couple of McKinsey consultants, called CEO Excellence. I've just started, so I can't say very much about it, but it seems to be really interesting as well. Different perspective on CEO's way of outperforming.
Thanks for all those recommendations. And Torbjörn Arenbo, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about capital allocation and value creation. Do you have something more you want to add before we finish up?
Well, I'm really honored to speak to you guys, not least since all of my great inspirational sources have been on this podcast before me, so I'm almost a bit starstruck by that. But thanks a lot, guys.
Great. And lastly, where can our audience follow you and your work?
Well, I guess the best way is to find me on LinkedIn.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @ib_redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.